The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 54.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. In this one, it's just me. I want to speak about this common trend I've seen on both the left and the right. And it's frustrating for me as an economist when I encounter this sort of rhetorical dodge, in my opinion, and I want to explain a bit more about what I mean. And I think once I put my finger on it and show you what I'm talking about, you'll maybe be able to notice it in the discourse at large. And so I want to be clear, I'm not here saying, hey, as an economist, I have the final answer on all these issues of government policy and social problems, and you other disciplines need to shut up and listen to me. That's not what I'm saying. Rather, what I'm saying is people with whom I disagree will make a claim that is fundamentally based on an economic concept or further claim. And so then when I come in as an economist and say, no, actually, the foundation of what you just said is wrong, and here's why, sometimes what they'll do is not say, no, I really think you're wrong. I know you're an economist, but actually you've got this economic issue wrong. And no, they'll just say, oh, well, yeah, that's looking at it in terms of dollars and cents, you bean counter, but we're talking about broader things than just GDP. And so you notice the rhetorical move there. In other words, they base their claim on something that is clearly an economic statement. I'll come in and say, I disagree with that. And not that I'm necessarily right just because of my background as an economist, but presumably I'm more of an authority on this than they are. Again, doesn't mean I'm necessarily right, but it means other things equal, I probably know more about that particular claim and at least how we would assess it. Maybe there's lots of things that I know are involved in the question that I'm going to make sure everybody in the discussion is aware of. And then instead of the person who made the initial claim that, again, fundamentally rests on some economic proposition, sometimes what happens, instead of that person either saying, huh, okay, you're right, I'll have to think about that, or sticking to his or her guns and saying, no, you're wrong, I realize you have more training, but instead they'll act like I'm being imperialistic with disciplines by trying to make this, oh, just a narrow economic question. And they say, yeah, that's the economic angle, but I'm not looking at this like an economist. What I'm saying is, and they'll make it sound as if their claim wasn't based on economics when it was. So that's what I'm saying in terms of the title of this podcast episode, how the left and the right move the goalposts in economic arguments. And I'll give two specific examples that are fresh in my mind because these happened to me recently, but I think this is a more general phenomenon. So why don't I think it'll be an easier sell since my audience, I think, is largely on the right, at least when it comes to economic issues. And so let's start with when the left does it. And I think you, if I'm describing you as someone who's on the right in terms of economics, you'll be able to really see what I mean and see how much of an unfair, bogus, rhetorical move it is in this context. All right. So the issue is slavery. So I have an article at Mises.org. I'll link to in the show notes. So this is BobMurphyShow.com/54 if you want to check out the links. So I have a recent article on slavery, and the context here is there is a large push for people on the left to revisit slavery in the United States and all of the ramifications it has had on our culture and economic development. And there's historians and other social scientists who are making the claim that American capitalism was built on slavery, or slavery was the engine that fueled the growth of the U.S. economy. And I'm generalizing here. So obviously, different scholars might have different nuances, but there is certainly a strand of thought saying something like this. Hey, Africans were brought to the United States as slaves. This was a monstrous injustice. The economic system at that time stole their productivity from them, the fruit of their labor. And this enriched not only the immediate people involved in this theft, but it showered economic benefits on American society at large. And so nowadays, if somebody brings up reparations, for example, and a standard right-wing Republican talking point in response is to say, ooh, you know, my great-grandparents didn't own slaves, or, you know, my parents just came over because of the potato famine, or, you know, my grandma came over and, you know, we had nothing to do with that. And so don't look at me. I had, and the problem with that, again, I'm still speaking as this strand of thought among certain progressive leftists. The problem with that is to say, no, your whiteness per se has privileged you, and you actually have benefited financially from this system of oppression. So whether you directly held the whip, or whether your ancestors held the whip and then you directly inherited a house, let's say, that was built out of the profits from slave trading, nonetheless, your ancestors who came to this country, even if they came later, they benefited from this initial exploitation, from that system of exploitation, which systematically robbed a certain group of people. And so you did benefit from that, and you're still benefiting from it, even, you know, as the reverberations of that still are seen around us to this very day. And so that's what we're talking about. And so when it comes to reparations, you know, we can talk about all kinds of other nuances here, but don't think you're off the hook. You did indeed benefit financially from this. In fact, what made the U.S. into a world economic power was slavery. And so don't, you know, you Trump supporters wearing your MAGA hats, what made America great as you so define it was slavery and then, you know, Jim Crow and all that kind of stuff. So this is a huge stain on the U.S. Scene or legacy in terms of its role in world history. And again, say what you will about it, but you did benefit from it financially. And that's why when it comes to reparations, for example, it's no excuse for you just to point to your family tree and say your ancestors weren't directly involved. All right. So that's, again, there's nuances, but I think there clearly are people making arguments along those lines. So my modest point in response to that is to say, actually, slavery is a very inefficient system. So of course it's a moral monstrosity. It's completely unjust, but like most things, if something is very unjust and immoral, it also is not efficient, properly assessed. All right. And so I'm just going off a little tangent here. That's the thing that's nice about the Rothbardian worldview, is there's not too many places where you really have to, you know, decide, oh, gee, do I want to uphold my principles or do I want to choose the pragmatic thing? That no, and case after case, things that you may have thought originally, like, oh, yeah, I wish I could live in a world where we didn't have systematic theft, but then I just kind of know as a practical consequence, without government police, there'd be bank robbers left and right and serial rapists happening, you know, going all over the place. And without government taxation and military defense, we'd be sitting ducks for it. And in the Rothbardian view, it's like, no, actually, those pragmatic statements, those, you know, just neutral statements as an analyst of how does the world work, actually, those are wrong. In a free society that does not engage in taxation and does not have a government monopoly on the police and the court system and military defense, actually would have a better response to crime. It would minimize crime more efficiently. There'd be fewer bank robberies. There'd be fewer rapes. There'd be fewer home invasions in a free society. And we wouldn't be getting invaded by foreign powers. Okay. So there's no trade-off there. Right. So that's, you know, in general, how the Rothbardian thing works. And so likewise here, my understanding of the economics is that we don't have to say, yes, slavery was an immoral system, but hey, say what you will about it, it did make the rest of the country richer. No. slavery made the average white person in the United States poorer than he otherwise would have been. Okay. And so what I pointed out in the Mises.org article is that sometimes it's hard to assess, you know, what's the counterfactual? Or it's just, so when we say, hey, did slavery increase American output or did slavery enhance the U.S. economy historically? We have to say, well, compared to what? So if you mean, for example, suppose in the year 1840, all of a sudden, all the slaves who were tilling the fields just disappeared. You know, aliens came and beamed them up and, you know, took them away to Mars or something where they were free. What would that do to measured U.S. GDP? Well, of course, it would go down. Nobody's doubting that. You take away a bunch of productive people, output's going to drop. But that's what that's showing is not so much that slavery is productive. That's showing that those black workers were productive and that their labor contributed to output. And so if you took them away, output would go down. To assess whether slavery per se is efficient or is productive, the correct counterfactual would be something like, suppose in the year 1840, all the plantation owners read abolitionist tracts and were suddenly, you know, convicted by the Holy Spirit and said, oh, what have we done? This is terrible. And they freed all their slaves. Would U.S. GDP plummet? And in particular, like, look at the long-term consequences. Are the leftist progressives who are making these claims about how much U.S. or American capitalism was built on slavery and how American greatness as measured in the way that like a Donald Trump supporter would mean that term really rests on the systematic exploitation? Are they saying that if in 1840, all of the slaves were liberated voluntarily by their owners, that U.S. wealth in the aggregate in, say, the year 1900 would have been lower than it was in fact? Because that's what you have to be saying. Because if you agree with me that, no, actually, aggregate output would have been higher and total wealth creation would have been greater had the U.S. just gotten rid of slavery with the snap of your fingers, you know, without a war and so forth, which was destructive. If that's true, then we see slavery per se was not an engine of growth for the U.S. economy. It was a break. It was a cause of sluggishness. It was a hindrance that the U.S. economy grew in spite of slavery. And if they had just gotten rid of slavery, it would have grown even faster. Okay, so these are empirical claims, and I'll probably do some more research and write more on this. So to give an example of the kind of thing I mean, let me make sure people understand I'm not just making the really obvious claim, right? That clearly if you include the utility of the slaves in your calculation of, you know, national well-being or something, and let's put aside methodological problems about what does that even mean, Bob, about, you know, you can't aggregate psychic happiness and so forth, then clearly it goes through, right? Just, I mean, it's pretty standard, like measured by normal economist techniques about willingness to pay and stuff like that. Somebody enslaves somebody else, that's inefficient in a mainstream law and economics point of view, because the slave values his freedom more than the owner does. And yet, you know, there's a market flaw there, right? The slave, theoretically speaking, the owner should be willing to free the slave, and the slave then buys his freedom over time and stuff like that. You could say, oh, well, credit markets weren't there, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so it actually gets to be a pretty interesting question as to, if you had a totally free market in every other respect, but there were these, you know, this anomaly where people could be owned by others just as legal property titles. I actually think, and I've made arguments elsewhere on this, that would get eroded pretty quickly. Cause again, it's just inefficient, right? People value their freedom as it's per se. And so there's elements there. Think of it too, that like the most productive slaves have an incentive to shield, you know, they're not going to volunteer any ideas they have. They're sitting there tilling the field. Somebody looks around, he has a great idea. Well, if he's not going to volunteer that, right? So there's lots of reasons to suppose that productivity would be enhanced under a system of free labor. And so in general, you would think the market economy would tap into that. Okay. And so there are plenty of economists, and I'll have like Martin Thornton on here on the Bob Murphy Show eventually, with the next 10 episodes, let's say. And we're going to talk about that. So I'll defer those interesting thoughts till later. But again, just as a tantalizing thing to keep you coming back for more, I actually do think it was government intervention that propped up slavery as an institution. But put that aside. I just want to clarify right now, when I'm saying I think slavery was an inefficient system, I'm not making the sort of obvious claim that it, you know, if you include the welfare of the slaves, obviously it was bad. I'm saying just consider, for example, the white people in the United States, that slavery made them poorer than they otherwise would have been. Now, if that sounds shocking to you, I think it's because you're not thinking through the problem carefully. And that's partly why I'm doing this, is I want to really challenge you and get you to think this through. So clearly, the person who goes and physically captures somebody and ships them across the ocean and sells them, you could say, you know, that person's better off because of the existence of slavery, right? That person had a choice among occupations, and his most productive outlet was physically capturing people and selling them into bondage. Okay. So you could say that person's better off. You could even say the plantation owners are better off. But again, even here, it's not as obvious as you think, right? Because if a plantation owner had to pay for the slaves, you know, the market price there fully reflects their expected future surplus, right? So just think that through. So again, I'm just trying to clarify here, the casual, oh yeah, slavery is good for the, you know, the oppressor class, but it's bad for the slaves. That's true, but it gets nuanced real quickly when you're trying to pinpoint exactly who benefits from it. Okay, so again, I just want to repeat the point. If you're just a normal plantation owner and somebody brings over people he captured or that he bought from somebody else in Africa and comes over on a ship and is selling them at auction, you're not getting the slaves for free. You're having to pay for them. Okay, now in general, you know, so just like somebody has to buy oxen, yes, the plantation owners benefit from the existence of oxen and so on, but, you know, do they benefit more than the ranchers? Okay, do you see what I'm saying? So it gets nuanced pretty quickly. But here's what I'm pointing out. The issue is, what about everybody else, right? Because most people weren't slave owners, even white people. And so the question is, did they benefit from it or not? And so I want to say that, no, I think if in this thought experiment, if all of a sudden, again, like in 1840, everybody had a change of heart and freed their slaves, there's a sense in which that's just an immediate transfer of wealth, right? So think of it this way. Let's say there's a particular slave and he's worth $1,000, right? Like if his, you know, legal owner went and sold him at auction to some other plantation owner in the next town, that he'd get $1,000 for him. So instead, the guy reads abolitionist tracts. Oh, wow. He's convicted. You know, he can't sleep at night. He feels so guilty. He frees his slave the next morning. So there's a sense in which he just gave a gift, if you will, a transfer of $1,000 in wealth from himself to the slave. Okay. And so that's, you know, that's fine. But then the question is, all right, what did that transfer do to everybody else? You know, the other white people, let's say, who weren't directly involved. I think it's pretty clear that in general, they're all going to be wealthier in the aggregate. And so that's where I'm coming from here. All right. So that's the kind of thing we want to pin down when we're talking about this. You know, just for example, you no longer have to have people devoted to keeping slaves in bondage and, you know, tracking them down, right? If it's all free labor, you don't need to worry about somebody running away. So all of the resources that had previously been devoted to maintaining the prison camp, as it were, those people and resources can now be devoted, you know, elsewhere. And so that's the sense in which it makes society richer. All right. So just think through the logic of that. So again, here, my point isn't so much to flesh out this particular train of thought. I just want to clarify what the train of thought is. All right. And so if that's true, if in general, a society that doesn't have slavery is richer than a society that does have slavery, then all these arguments about, you know, reparations and so forth fall apart. So yeah, if you can make a clear cut historical argument and say, hey, this particular family, they inherited this wealth that we can trace back, whatever, four or five generations and show this was directly derived from people who were captured and sold into bondage, okay, then you can go ahead and make a particular claim that, yep, these people who inherited that, they should pay, you know, the descendants of the victims. Just like if you could prove that, you know, your grandfather swindled my grandfather because he's, you know, forged a land title or something. And if I could really prove that, then I could make a claim and maybe get some compensation. But this idea of, in general, you could have reparations based on that, it falls apart. So an analogy here, which just to, again, clarify what my claim is, let's say there's a bank robbery, okay, and there's three people involved. So the guy Al, so it's going to be Al, Bob, and Charlie for ABC, just to keep the names right. So initially, they all have $33, all right, so it adds up to 99 to make it close to 100%, just for percentage calculation. So originally, the distribution of wealth is roughly the same. Al goes into the bank, pulls out a gun, and robs Bob and Charlie. But the thing is, he takes different amounts from them. So Al sticks the gun in Bob's face and takes $3 from him. He sticks the gun in Charlie's face and takes $30 from him. Okay, so when all is said and done because of this robbery, Al walks out of there with $66, right, because he gained 33 plus his original 33. Bob walks out of there with 30, right, because he started with 33 and got robbed three of it. And poor Charlie walks out with only 3 because he started with 33 and had 30 taken from him. Okay, so there was a big redistribution from the other two to Al. And so clearly, Al is the aggressor there and Charlie is a victim. And if he can demonstrate in a court of law what happened, then he's entitled to at least, you know, the 30 plus, you know, maybe some for his pain and suffering. But what I want to claim is Charlie certainly cannot claim that Bob owes him money because Bob was made poorer also. And Charlie certainly can't say, well, if you look at the distribution of income, you know, I went, you know, originally we were all the same. And now, you know, Bob is 10 times wealthier than I am, right? He has $30. I only have 3. So that's clearly, you know, Bob's relative position compared to me was greatly enhanced by this exploitation. So therefore he should, in the interest of fairness, give me some compensation to level the playing field a little bit. I think, you know, in this scenario, most people say, well, no, actually, Bob was robbed too. I mean, not nearly as much as you were, but Bob doesn't owe you compensation for the fact that somebody else's theft made both of you poorer, even though it hits you harder. Okay, so that's kind of where I'm coming from when I want to say slavery as an institution clearly benefited some people. I mean, that's why it persisted. You know, if literally no one was made better off, it wouldn't have happened. So clearly, there were some people who benefited from it and from its maintenance, but I want to say the general bulk of society was made poorer by it. And so if that's the case, then you can hardly claim, or at least it would be very difficult to claim, that there needs to be systematic reparations nowadays based on, you know, racial disparities. Okay, so that's the claim. Now, in response to that, some leftist progressives will dispute the claims about economics. And they'll say, no, you're wrong. Actually, you know, slavery really did benefit. And there's some particular things here. And that's what I want to get into the more I get research this. And like I said, I'm going to have Mark Thornton on and we're going to get into the nitty gritty of it. Things like certain regions of the South, you know, their per capita income grew faster than the North over certain time periods, stuff like that, where they really are trying to, or certain farms, or, you know, plantations were more profitable in the South than their analogs of farms based on free labor in the North, stuff like that. Okay. So I applaud those people. They're making the argument, right? They're trying to take it my kind of view head on and say, no, Murphy, you're just wrong. But another type of response will just shift the goalposts. And so that's the thing that's falling under the umbrella of this current podcast episode, is where people, you know, if I make an argument like this, they'll say, no, you're missing the point. This isn't about whether these other people, you know, may have more or less money. The point is slavery established this hierarchy based on race. And so in this pecking order, yes, the white person who, you know, was landless was much lower in social prestige than the sort of aristocrats who owned slaves. I grant you that. But they were still higher than the freed blacks, let alone the slaves. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. And that we can see that persist even to this day with the disparity in police treatment and right, and that kind of stuff. And so I want to say, whoa, hang on, that you've now transformed it, all right? That it's gone from what was a very specific economic claim to now just saying, well, it's a matter of prestige and social standing and things like that. So that's fine. And if you want to say, yes, slavery made the average white person poorer, but maybe he benefited from psychological, you know, feelings of superiority or gave him self-esteem, something like that. Okay, you can make that claim and, you know, maybe we can debate it or not. But originally, this started out as a claim that was primarily based on economics, talking about American capitalism. And again, when it comes to reparations, that's clearly based on claims about unfair redistribution of income. And so if the economic claims that I offered in response are true, then those statements about capitalism and about the U.S. economy and slavery being the engine of its growth and all that kind of are just wrong. And it won't do to just wave that away and say, oh, you economists, geez, that's just like you. We're sitting here with this horrible system of oppression and you're sitting over here looking at the growth in per capita income. Give me a break. Hey, you guys are the ones who made these claims. And I'm responding saying, no, I think those are wrong. Okay, so that's the example of what I'm talking about in this podcast episode with respect to slavery and, you know, the legacy in terms of the economic growth, and in particular with regards to claims about reparations nowadays. Hey folks, let's take a break from my scintillating discussion to mention the Laura Murphy Report. Now this comes up in the episode, but I want to explain that I am writing about the current yield curve inversion and trade war with China and what's going on with the currency devaluation, all that stuff, particularly in the July, August, and September issues of the Laura Murphy Report. So if those things really interest you and you want to know my views on that, the place to go is the Laura Murphy Report. So go to bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. Okay. So I think most of you, my listeners, followed that argument and you understand where I'm coming from and you can appreciate why it's frustrating if people on the left lead with claims about economics and I say, no, actually, let's clarify your thinking there. That's fuzzy. And then if the response, at least among some people, is not to then, you know, grapple with my response, but just to say, oh, you're looking at it like an economist. This is a very broad issue. It's more than just bean counting, you idiot. Okay, so that's, you see why that would be frustrating. Okay, so the right does that just as well. So for example, back in episode 40 here, you guys may remember I had an episode called Tucker Carlson Wants Affirmative Action for American Workers. And I was going through and just explaining how the things Tucker Carlson wants to do, where he was praising Elizabeth Warren, talking about corporations and how they're not loyal to Americans and the stuff, you know, that ought to be done. And I was saying, no, that would actually make Americans per se poorer. And I was showing why, for example, outsourcing makes Americans richer on net or per capita. That yes, a given act of outsourcing or a given episode of outsourcing might hurt certain workers, right? So if you're an American worker working for a company, the shareholders of the company are looking at the numbers, you know what? If we ship this factory and we move this factory, outsource it to Mexico and make the product there with the cheaper labor cost, and then we import the goods and sell them here to the same market, we'll save 10% on labor costs. And so, you know, that's good. We'll do that. So yes, that particular episode will hurt the wages of the U.S. workers who used to work at that factory. But I was saying, as long as there's competition, it will lower the prices of those goods that used to be produced in the U.S. And so American consumers benefit. And also to the extent that company, its shareholders are American, they benefit too, right? So initially, if the savings and labor cost is all just profit, extra, you know, net income to the shareholders, well, to the extent that they're American shareholders and they benefit. But then over time, again, competition is going to ensure that those fat margins now are going to get whittled away. And so ultimately, it's going to be U.S. consumers who are going to benefit from that. And so that's just the standard logic of free trade in general, or why tariffs do not make the country richer as a whole, that, yeah, there's particular winners and losers on any given act. But if the gains to the winners outweigh the losses to the losers, the whole thing, you know, makes America richer on net. Okay, so that's the argument I made. And in response, somebody, for example, on Facebook said something like, yeah, this is the problem with you autistic libertarians. Tucker Carlson cares about culture, not just low price of TVs and Walmart, you effing idiot, or you know, something like that. Okay, so do you notice that's exactly the kind of move that our leftist friends make with on the slavery and reparations issue? That Tucker Carlson was making quite clearly an economic claim. In fact, he even called it economic nationalism. I don't think Warren called it that because I think she realized that sounds too much like Donald Trump. But Tucker Carlson, when he was praising Elizabeth Warren's plan, called it economic nationalism. So if you're going to be an economic nationalist, you have to respect economics. All right. I'm trying to be polite here. I was going to originally title this episode that economic nationalists need to learn some economics or something like that. But that, you know, that's too, I'm an economist and you guys are idiots tone. Okay. So again, it's not that economics is all you need to solve these questions or to answer these questions. There's more involved, but clearly to the extent that you're using economic propositions to make your case, the propositions have to be correct, right? So if you're saying, oh, I'm drawing on politics and I'm drawing on culture and I'm drawing on whatever, healthy masculinity, and I'm drawing on economics to come up with a set of policy proposals that any red-blooded American ought to support. Well, if you're drawing on economics that are wrong, then that's a problem, especially if it flips your argument. Okay, so in particular, if your policies make America poorer, that's not economic nationalism. That's the opposite of economic nationalism. All right, so if the critic responds to my episode 40, where I go through and critique Tucker Carlson's narrative and says, oh yeah, Bob, sure. Maybe passing a rule that these companies can't outsource, maybe that makes America as a whole poorer, but I don't care because to me, culture's more important. Okay, fine. But then call yourself a cultural nationalist or call yourself a nationalist or something, but don't call yourself an economic nationalist, because economic nationalist makes it sound like you're saying, I care about the economy or the economic fortunes of Americans, screw the rest of the world. Like, we're looking out for Americans. We're not going to sign these trade deals that benefit the, you know, Chinese manufacturers. We're going to look out for Americans. And that's, you know, fine. Okay. I mean, we could debate the morality of that, whether it's okay to violate property rights to do so. But my point is, if what you're doing when you, quote, hurt those Chinese manufacturers is also make Americans as a whole poorer, well, then that's stupid. You're not helping Americans. You're not looking out for Americans if you're making them poorer. Okay, so again, I know there are people who challenge free trade or the, you know, the conventional economist description of free trade. They'll say, hey, you guys make a bunch of assumptions there. The real world doesn't correspond to the thought experiment of David Ricardo. And that's fine. And believe me, I've seen a lot of free market economists like Don Boudreau and others who sometimes I think are a little bit, over the top, let's say, or they're too glib when they're responding to some type of protectionist argument and they actually say things that aren't quite right. Or that if you took that logic and applied it to a household, it would clearly be wrong. Okay, and so it's not that I disagree with their conclusions, but Don knows that I'm trying to keep them honest and stuff, and that it's all friendly fire, and I've done that stuff on my blog a lot for those who are interested. Okay, so believe me, I understand a sort of right wing conservative who's familiar with free market economics, but never drank the Kool-Aid all the way. I understand how they could look at the way some economists glibly talk about free trade and say, whoa, you guys are leaving out a whole lot here from the analysis. And that's fine. So again, I'm not saying, hey, I went to school and got a PhD in economics, so I'm allowed to talk about this and you have to shut your mouth and listen. That's not what I'm saying. Rather, though, what I'm saying is if Tucker Carlson's going to talk about how he's an economic nationalist and we got to stop these companies from outsourcing because we got to do what's right for American workers. And then I show, well, no, actually, American workers in general are hurt by these proposals, economically hurt. they're made poorer, their wages buy less stuff at the store, then it doesn't do to just say, oh, you're just talking about cheap goods. We're not talking about that. We're talking about culture. Okay. And so let me try something else here. What if I said, or not me, what if Stephanie Calton, the MMT lady who's advising Bernie Sanders, or she did, I don't know if she is officially on his campaign now. What if Stephanie Calton comes out and says, hey, I don't see what the problem is. I have a great solution to boost manufacturing wages. Let's just have the Fed print up $10 trillion and dump that into the economy. I guarantee you, if we go measure the wages paid to manufacturing workers in this country, they will go up. Guarantee you. Bet my life on it. And then, you know, the CNBC calls a bunch of economists. They email me and say, hey, Dr. Murphy, we know you're a critic of MMT. Do you agree that if the Fed printed up $10 trillion, right now the average manufacturing wage is such and such? Do you think workers, if we checked in 10 years down the road, would be getting more dollars per hour than they are right now? I would say, yes, they will. So, end of story. MMT wins. If the goal is to boost manufacturing wages, all we got to do is print up $10 trillion and dump it around the country. How do you guys feel about that? Especially if you're a fan of Tucker Carlson. I think we'd all say, no, that's stupid, because yes, the wages you get paid from your boss are going to go up in dollar terms, but when you go to the store, everything's going to be that much more expensive too. So your real wages actually probably will be lower when the dust settles, because there's going to be a lot of transition uncertainty and a lot of mistakes will be made and capital will be consumed. Businesses will expand that shouldn't, because they're going to misread the market signals. And you don't make a country richer by just printing up fiat dollars and handing them around, right? So suppose then Stephanie Calton hears that objection and says, Dr. Murphy, for example, agreed with you, Professor Calton, that it would raise manufacturing wages in dollar terms, but he pointed out that it would also make prices at Walmart and the gas station go up even more. And so manufacturing workers would be able to buy less stuff at the store with their wages every 2 weeks when they get paid. And so actually they would be hurt by your proposal. What do you say? And suppose she said, I'm not worried about the prices of consumer goods. I'm talking here about the honor and integrity and self-respect and self-esteem of these manufacturing workers. And we got to help them and raise their wages. That's what I'm talking about. Let's not quibble about, ooh, how much is the latest iPhone, or I want to get a cheap TV at Walmart. Who cares about that? I'm talking about wages. Wouldn't that be goofy? Wouldn't that be shockingly naive if she said that? And by the way, I don't think she would say something that obtuse, right? Okay, so in that setting, clearly somebody who said, oh, let's just do something that raises nominal wage rates and let's not worry about what happens to prices, that would be goofy. That would be missing the whole point. All right. So likewise, if Tucker Carlson advances a proposal that ostensibly claims to help U.S. workers, and I point out, no, it won't. It will make what workers end up being able to buy at the store with their paychecks will be less stuff when the dust settles if we do what you're saying. You can argue with me and say I'm wrong, but you can't say, oh, I don't care about what the prices at Walmart are. I'm talking about U.S. jobs here. That's goofy. All right. You're dodging the question. You're not helping workers if you make the purchasing power of their wages go down. I had toyed with going through an example, because I made this argument about economic nationalists need to respect economics. I made this argument in a recent issue of the Laura Murphy Report. And in there, I walked through an example of the classic case for free trade. And I, you know, came up with a thing where there's the U.S. and I think it was India, or maybe it was Mexico. And I just had two goods and I showed how, even though U.S. workers were more physically productive in both lines, it was like jet engines and something else. I forget what the other thing was, like sweaters or something, right? As I made up nice round numbers to keep the math easy. And it was just showing, even if U.S. workers can make more jet engines per hour or more sweaters per hour than Mexican workers, nonetheless, we can start in a position of autarky where all the U.S. workers make jet engines and sweaters that are used by Americans, and the Mexican workers make any jet engines and sweaters used by Mexicans. And we, you know, have that equilibrium. And then we open it up to trade. And because of the numbers I chose, the U.S. advantage in jet engines was bigger. So they specialize in making jet engines. the Mexican workers specialize in making sweaters, and then they trade. And I showed how Americans can have more jet engines and more sweaters per capita relative to the original situation. And the same is true for the Mexicans. Okay. So everybody gets more stuff. So that's clearly showing how a rich country where their workers are more productive and everything can still benefit materially. They can have more stuff per person if they specialize in those lines where they're really good and outsource to another region where those workers are actually inferior, physically speaking, in every line, but they are still nonetheless specialized in the areas where their weakness is the least. All right. And if you've never actually seen one of those numerical demonstrations, I encourage you to do so. So I think you should subscribe to the Laura Murphy Report, number one. I had toyed with actually going through the numbers here on the podcast, but I thought you'd have to get on a piece of paper and write it down. And I think it's probably not worth it, that not enough of you would actually do that. But again, just make sure you understand the logic there, what I just said. And because I think maybe some of you don't fully grasp how powerful the standard classical case for free trade really is. All right. So there is more physical stuff per person to go around. And if the way you're thinking about it, that doesn't seem possible, you're thinking about it wrong. And the intuition is, just think of it in terms of opportunity cost, that if you're measuring like how many worker hours does it take to make jet engines versus sweaters in the US, and then you have other numbers for Mexico, the issue is not, it takes fewer US worker hours to make a sweater than how many Mexican worker hours, so it's cheaper. No, it's opportunity cost. In the United States, the more sweaters they make, the fewer jet engines there are. And so the cost of making more sweaters measured in jet engines is higher in the US than it is in Mexico. And so that's why it makes sense for the US to focus on making jet engines and import, to export jet engines to buy sweaters. Okay, because the jet engine price of sweaters is lower in Mexico than it is in the US. So that's why it's too expensive to make them in the US. Okay, so let me just say that one more time. What happens in a situation where, let's say, US workers per hour can make more jet engines and they can make more sweaters compared to their Mexican counterparts, it might seem as if the US should just make both. And if Americans, they should make as many jet engines as they want to use and make as many sweaters as they want to use based on how many labor hours they have to go around and what their preferences are for those two goods. But that's wrong, because the cost, when you're thinking of it like that, if there's full employment, the cost of making more sweaters means, we have fewer jet engines now that we can make, because American labor can be allocated to one line versus the other. If you're going to make more sweaters, then that takes more labor going into that industry. And so that means there's less labor to be devoted to jet engine production. So whatever the particular numbers you made up, the more sweaters you make with US workers, the fewer jet engines they're allowed to produce. So there's, in a sense, it's like more sweaters has a price measured in jet engines, or that's the opportunity cost, if you will. And so I'm saying you do the same calculation for Mexico and you see that the jet engine price of sweaters is actually cheaper in Mexico than it is in the US. And so that's why, rather than the US getting sweaters by pulling workers out of the jet engine industry and switching them over to the sweater industry, instead, they should just make more jet engines that they're going to use domestically and ship the surplus across the border and trade it for sweaters. So I think David Friedman came up with it. It's a really cool analogy or thought experiment. He said, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something like, there's two technologies for making cars. One in the United States. One way is to send workers to Detroit into factories and they go in there and then cars shoot out. Another way is to send workers to Iowa and they harvest crops. And then we put the crops on a ship and send it over to Japan. And then the ship comes back full of cars. That's the other technology. So there are different recipes for turning US labor hours into cars. And why would you think, it seems kind of arbitrary to assume that, necessarily the best way to turn US labor hours into cars, the way, for a given quantity of number of hours to make how many cars, that, oh yeah, the technology that always is better is to send them into Detroit into factories and to crank out cars that way. Why? Couldn't the numbers be such that growing crops and putting them on a ship and then shipping across the ocean, and then we don't know what happens, somehow it just magically turns into cars and comes back. Maybe that's a better way of doing it. When you look at how many labor hours do we have to put in you know, and how many cars do we get for it? All right. So that's just another way of seeing it. Okay. So that's the logic of the case, you know, the standard case for free trade. And so you see there, it's not a question of, you know, oh, we're going to hurt U.S. workers because we want to help shareholders or something. No, when you look at it in those terms, clearly the average worker under free trade, where there's specialization, is wealthier, has a higher standard of living, has more jet engines and sweaters, or has more cars per capita doing it the one way versus the other. Now, in the real world, it gets more complicated because workers are different, right? In these little simplistic thought experiments, all the workers are interchangeable. But start with the simple case first where they're interchangeable and see how the logic works, and then you can extend it to more complicated cases. But it's the same logic showing that by shifting, by producing domestically the thing where we have the advantage, making more of it than we need, and then shipping it abroad to get stuff we want at a cheaper price, that allows us to get more stuff for our given inputs of labor hours and natural resources. We get a broader and greater mix of stuff. So you can say, hey, stuff's not important, but then be clear about that. You would say, hey, when I say I want to be an economic nationalist, what I mean is I'm going to make us materially poorer. You're going to have smaller houses, fewer clothes, fewer TVs, cars that aren't as cool, but at least you'll know we're not trading with those foreign companies. Okay, you can say something like that. Or at least, you know, you'll have more to make it less of a loaded deck. You could say, okay, at least you know, though, when you go and work for a factory, it's not going to go abroad. I mean, it might move to a different state. As far as I know, Tucker Carlson hasn't proposed once you build a factory in one state, you're not allowed to move it to a different state because that would mess with people's lives also. But, you know, to the extent that you're comforted knowing if I go to work for a factory, it's not going to go to a different country, even though that means for the amount they're going to pay me when I go to the store, the stuff I can buy, you know, the amount of medicine I can get, the amount of the size of the cars, the size of the house, so forth, that I'm going to get for my family is going to be less in the long run under this proposal. But I'm willing to be poorer just to know that my company is not going to go abroad and that's worth it to me. Okay, let's make that case. But to call that economic nationalism, to me, I think is very misleading. And I don't think the people who support that actually realize that's what the deal is. Okay, well, why don't I stop there? I think I've made the case. So in summary, the left and the right often move the goalposts in economic discussions. Again, I'm not saying economics settles the argument, but to the extent that an argument relies heavily on economic propositions, they had better be correct from an economic point of view. Thanks for listening, folks, and I'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.